it ever really in doubt? Really? No, of course it wasn't. Welcome to episode 608 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighbourhood host, Trey Harrison. Glad you could join us once again. And it's another nice, calm, quiet one episode week. Isn't it lovely? We've got a couple more of these to come before we've got Formula One back after its lengthy summer break. But our bikes is also back this weekend as well. The 1000th MotoGP race is coming to you from the Red Bull Ring next weekend. But in the meantime, we've got to talk about IndyCar in Portland. And well, RJ O'Connell's been teasing it for some time. In fact, Fox was starting to pay attention to that too this weekend. But in bright news, if you're a fan of the Rebels and the Death Star, Team Penske has won a race for the first time in 2025.
That is the sound of me throwing away my congrats Penske IndyCar sarcastic video tribute, a 3-minute montage of all of Penske's failures on the way to a winless season in 2025 that hadn't been done for the team in 26 years. And then Will Power had to go and ruin the whole thing and the entire narrative about him being so washed and being just about to fall over the cliff that he needed to be replaced before he got taken out and old Yeller back behind the Mooresville, North Carolina shop.
It was a narrative so toxic that RJ had actually remembered the whole thing off by heart and tattooed it to his eyelids. Impressive work, I must say. Also joining me, complete in Honda jacket and Alex Palou t-shirt, because he really did prepare for the occasion, it's Cam Buckley.
You can't hear this because this is only sometimes a visual medium. It's a middle finger.
Yes.
It's at Dre Harrison. That's okay. I've got my Honda jacket on. I've got my Alex Palou shirt on. Things are good.
Oh, he's at peace despite giving the bird on multiple occasions.
Would you like another?
But, oh, yes, please, honey. If you insist. Also, Raptor in the chat says, Honda doing well. What year is it?
I never really stopped over here in IndyCar. It has on two wheels. A little bit in F1. I don't think the Honda engine is the problem over at Red Bull right now.
No, in the same way that in IndyCar, Honda's won 12 out of 15 this season and have actually already wrapped up the Manufacturers' Championship.
Easy money.
Easiest money that Honda will ever make. And we had Marc Marquez in 2014, as you do. Let's talk a little bit about IndyCar in the next hour or so on this podcast. We're going to be talking about the Grand Prix of Portland, how Will Power won it from the front of the field, how Alex Palou ended up sealing the championship as Palou Award had to be wheeled to the back and then shot via a burnt-out ECU. Well, we'll talk a little bit about some of the wildest racing IndyCar has seen this year between Connor Daly and Christian Rasmussen that ended up going viral and having a lot of people batten down their respective hatches. And the weird element of the fact that Fox now actually owns a third of the series. That's a weird one. We'll break that down over the next hour or so on Motorsport 101. But in the meantime, here's some places you can find us. We're on YouTube.com/Motorsport101. We're on Facebook.com/Motorsport101. We're on Twitter at Motorsport_101. If you follow us on our Blue Sky, our personal handles are Dre Harrison, RJ O'Connell, and CBuckley917.bsky.social. If you want to catch our video highlights of the show, you can do so on our Instagram page, Motorsport101Pod, on TikTok at M101_podcast, and on our YouTube page as well, if you're into that sort of thing. All those details are on our website, motorsport101.com, and if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as Jason and Ghost Raptor is doing so right now. And this chat to Jason also pointed out, congrats, Mr. Buckley, for winning the prediction league for IndyCar this year. Yes, yes.
It was won
by default.
Yes, because Alex Palou is the default.
We got too cute about this, RJ.
No. The problem is that no one has ever been more wrong in the history of anything than Dre Harrison was about his Indy 500 prediction.
Listen. I was right for a very long time on this one. I mean, literally minus 45 seconds. It was a great time in my imagination.
Yes, he made minus like 3 miles. It's going to be one of those long shows for you.
That's a lot shorter than 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
Whatever that is,
doesn't matter. Let the record show, folks, that I will never have a worse prediction run for picking a guy to win the 500 or the Astor Cup than that, ever. It's from a great height.
Quantitatively, it's not really possible.
You got me there, yeah, to say the least. Right, after this quick musical interlude, we'll be back to talk all things Portland.
It's time. We've made it. 3 races to go. It's time for the anal stretch. Wait, sorry. Hold on a second. I'm reading this wrong.
Whoa.
It's the final stretch. Remember, font choice matters.
M101 after dark. And it's 4:30 in the afternoon.
You know, we all kind of knew in the back of our head that this was just a case of Pat O'Rourke trying to hit a huge 3 to cut the lead to 42. The points margin was much bigger in his case. I didn't think it'd end like this. So, yeah, obviously, Alex Palou wins the championship. Started 5th. Pat O'Rourke got pole, but O'Rourke burned out his ECU, and that effectively took him out of the race. The championship was decided pretty much then and there. Officially, on lap 101 of the 110-lap race.
On brand.
We had, as we'll talk about, the dumbest bit of driving for 20th place points that I've seen in a hot minute. And through all this, Will Powers Penske stayed out during that caution, ran a huge early lead, so when he did stop, he took the net lead for Felix Rosenqvist and Quist on strategy and didn't look back. Came under pressure in the end from Christian Lundgaard and Palou. Power held his nerve and staved off the pressure for his first win of 2025. Penske avoids the winless skid. And narratively speaking, the man that is closest to being pushed out, because he's 44 this year, let's just say Penske season.
Saved is extremely relative.
And generous.
Yeah, this is still a almost universally disastrous season for Team Penske.
Okay, can I rephrase? It's the difference between a massive 20-car pileup and a slightly smaller 3-car pileup.
I guess that's a start.
Yeah.
You
reduce the horn. It's like the ratchet effect.
Yeah, in real-world terms, like, we were looking at Penske's potentially first winless season since 1999. They have avoided that with their first win. And look, fair play to Penske. Will Power's won this race multiple times before. He's always gone well at Portland.
Dominated this race last year.
Dominated the race last year. Alex Palou was one of the few times Palou just did not have an answer for Power on the day on that one. And Power did it again here. He had to be a bit more creative this time around. It was staying out on that early caution. A lot of guys wanted to get rid of their primary tyres because the field pretty much predicted and they were right to do so. But it was going to be a red tyre race. Power staying out, wanted track position, knew Palou was going to be directly behind him who was on the primary, so he could just basically run up a big gap, which he did, and because everybody else was caught in traffic, that way he actually did come in for his first scheduled stop. He got out ahead of Felix Rosenqvist, who was the key man on the same strategy as him, and after that, Power didn't really look back. It was just him managing the pace. The only other guy that was followed him the whole way through until the end was Christian Lundgaard, who, again, ran his primary stint early, but he got off that primary tyre during that early stop. They ended up shaking out on track together, and, well, Power just held Lundgaard off the whole way. Palou had to run the long way around, had to catch up by running fresh alternates at the end of the race, got to the pack, and then got stuck because this car is not great. In dirty air and in traffic situations, again.
Even at the best of times with the IR18, you don't want to be the third person in line. And because of lap traffic, he was actually the 4th.
Mm.
And that actually allowed power to almost take refuge within the dirty air of Ericsson, because it meant that Ludgard couldn't really get close enough to him either.
If you really wanted to get tinfoil about it, I mean, Marcus Ericsson was just trying to wheel in and stave off, you know, the team that he just got dropped from and the team that he got dropped from before that in a roundabout way.
Tinfoil on tinfoil. You're just welding a box of steel around your head at that point. But no, I mean, second year in a row that Will has just looked like prime willpower around here. Something about this place that just agrees with him. And man, did Penske need this? Yes, because the day still didn't go well for Scotty and for Joseph Newgarden. Well, you ever watched the original Sin City movie?
Yeah.
Remember the big fat kill?
Yeah.
Yeesh. That kind of yeesh.
Yeah, Newgarden was having a good day. He was probably going to... He was on course, in my opinion, for probably a top five finish, and then got spun out by Scott Dixon and stalled his car. Had to wait a whole last lap so they could get the hybrid going again to restart it. And, well, yeah, Newgarden lost a lap at that point, and his day was effectively done. No other caution to speak of in the race to potentially get that lap back. And yeah, that was the end of Newgarden's day effectively. And McLaughlin just didn't have the pace soft tire wise to stay with power. And yeah, he dropped back in the later stages. It was looking like another bad day for Penske, except for Will, who was virtually flawless. It says a lot about Will and Penske that, you know, they're still taking this seriously, and this was a classic Penske race, executed their strategy to perfection, and, you know, Power did what he needed to do at the front, managed the front beautifully.
Needed great handled pit the stops. Traffic. Got him.
Yeah. Got the great stops, handled the traffic, passed the lap cars when he needed to, just to maintain the pressure. And to be fair, Lingard was also juggling Alex Palou behind him and having to hit a fuel number as well, which did not help his odds of trying to go for the win. But Power was flawless. You know, it really was a classic willpower victory. You forget he's fourth on the all-time win list sometimes, but Will made sure we all remembered, because he was emphatic after that race about wanting to stay and proving that he still had the pace to be able to contend. We heard it in interviews before and after this race that I don't think Will wants to go anywhere. He's had no rumblings or talk of retirement, despite him being 44 years of age now. He wants this, and we are still talking about a man who could be a free agent at the end of the season. He's not allowed to start talking to teams until September 1st, pretty much a day after the season finishes. But he's a free agent. It's up in the air, and we don't know what the future's going to lie like, RJ.
After the race, he said, I won three races last year. If you're a team, if you're waiting on me to know if I'm good enough, I don't know what you're thinking. If you're actually waiting, like, I'm not sure if this guy is good enough, just go back to last year and you'll know. That's the official quote as printed by racer.com. There's another adjective in between you'll and know that was omitted from this text.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was fornicating. Yes.
Will Power. Will Power still got it, man. I understand, like, the concern that, like, you don't know how long a driver like this has left to be at the top of this game. But from my vantage point, Will's not been the problem. Any of us on the panel could tell you this.
And especially in a year with
that.
Yeah, like Penske are in a full rebuild right now. They blew this team up after the 500 debacle, which, incredibly, ironically enough, started looking at the attenuator on the number 12 Verizon Chevy.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been the sole shred of consistency, at least behind the wheel, at Penske. Because Joseph, we know. We don't need to get into it. Scott McLaughlin has looked like a shell of himself since that Indy 500 incident. Like, and Will has had more instances of bad luck, more than anything else, derail a couple of his races that have been going well this year. Couple engine failures, couple just weird mechanical issues. and he really should be higher in the points than he is as a result. A lot of this has not been self-inflicted this year, in a year where Penske are just all over the place with all three cars. It's really hard for me to see justifying, you know, moving on from Will.
Yeah. I know that, like, I like me some David Malukas. I think that first win's going to come. I wouldn't be surprised if it came in the final two races of the season, but no evidence I've seen suggests that that move is ready to be made for 2026.
Not yet.
I at least give it another year.
I'm fully in this camp of agreement. It's been the long-running narrative pretty much since last off-season, because Malukas was effectively saved career-wise by Roger Penske by paying for him to go to Foyt as part of the Penske expanded universe. He left Meyershank. Meyershank has brought in Marcus Armstrong, and by the way, he's having a fantastic season in that 66 car. Malukas, like, it's weird because, like, on the one hand, Malukas is having his best season in IndyCar right now. He's top 10 in points. He's had a podium finish at the Indy 500. He was fourth in Iowa Race 1. He's not had a bad season by any stretch. But there's also, for me, I think it's a very top-heavy kind of season. I think he's been held up a lot by his oval form this year. I'd like to see more of Malukas doing this well on road and street courses, which is still two-thirds of the season, before we start talking about associating him with an elite seat in the series.
I think the problem with that perspective is that Foyt have clearly regressed in that regard this year. I mean, this is the only time we are obligated to mention it. Santino Ferrucci had one of the biggest "what are you doing here" crashes of the year. Just spun up the rear tires and walled it.
The thing is as well, Ferrucci was looking really good mid-season. His form dropped off a cliff after that podium at Road America.
Well, I thought he was stone cold, and then all of a sudden he turned into Horace Hogan.
like I said, I like Little Dave. I think he is a Gen Z marketer's wet dream for Team Penske. There's a fresh face to guide them into the future. Yeah. I would have no problem with this Malukas move in 2 years' time. But I don't think he's the complete package yet. I mean, when Roger last made a drastic move, it was moving on from Helio Castroneves. And I need to point out, Helio Castroneves was fourth in the standings when Penske told him to kick rocks. Like, he still had won a race that season. They wanted to get the jump and bring in Joseph Newgarden. And obviously, Newgarden has been incredible in a Penske car over the course of the second half of his career. So I get why people are like, maybe Roger will be proactive and do so again, because he moved on from Helio when he was 44. But this is not the time. Will Power has been the most consistent Penske driver this year. And yes, maybe his ceiling isn't quite as high as the peaks of Joseph and Scott McLaughlin as his teammates, but he's still good enough to win races. He's good enough to stuff the stat sheet with solid points drives race to race, and quite frankly, it's a horrible look to move on from him now when Joseph has had, and look, I'm starting to actually lean more the way of Joseph's year has been more down to bad luck than his actual performances, and McLaughlin, who I think we need to be talking about a lot more about his difficulties this season compared to previous years, because I think a lot of McLaughlin shit has been self-inflicted this year. It just doesn't feel like the time is right. If, in my opinion, and I stand by this, and people can argue with me all they want on this one, if they were thinking about moving on from Will, the guy they should have got was Christian Lundgaard last year.
And you need to talk to your guy, by the way, on that shot block that he made to try and hold on to second place.
I didn't agree with it either, for what it's worth. I thought that was too much.
It's fine. It's fine. What's a small cut for victory? It's fine.
At this point, race direction is a joke, but we'll get into more of that later. But hey, sixth podium of the season for Christian Lundgaard. He's fourth in the standings in his first year of a big seat. I told you all.
McLaren team leader on pace alone. It is worth mentioning it from this race as well. Yes, Christian Lundgaard got pole for this race, actually. He was the fastest in qualifying, but took an engine penalty. Pato O'Ward.
That's brutal. This is our transition into championship time. I mean, Pato, this was always going to be a long shot. I didn't think there was any chance, like, even if something, God forbid, terrible happened out below, that he couldn't run the last three races of the season. Pato still basically had to win out.
Yes. The after qualifying, because of Christian Lundgaard getting the extra point, even though Pato inherited pole, it was as simple as this. If Pato finishes second, it's over. And that is with Pato getting every available point. And early on, didn't look too bad for Pato to get every available point. First pit stop arrives, and immediately, a wire to his direct injection control box, related to the engine control unit, decided that it was going to clock out early for the year. And that, as they say, was that.
Yeah, remind me. Would you like to tell the folks at home what company provides IndyCar stock engine control units and has since 2010?
It's this company called, let me read here, McLaren.
Oh.
Yeah, da 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 da.
Oh.
Mm.
Whoops.
Yes, this is clearly the Splinter Cell faction within McLaren that wishes to see the rule of Ron Dennis restored. I'm glad we got to see Pato go back out, much like Rosberg in F1 in 2014. He decided to go down with the ship. But man, they pitted that. They must have fixed that car like three times in the pits.
Yeah, he ended up, I think it was 10 laps down by the time it was all said and done. I think eight of those was the original fix, because that wiring failure led to his entire ECU basically being burnt to a crisp. And that, I said, that effectively ended the championship battle right there. And then it left the path completely clear for Alex Palou to just finish the car within the last 10 laps, and he's the champion. He ended up sealing the deal with a third place finish. And we got celebratory donuts and breaking out the championship t-shirts. Alex Palou is a four-time IndyCar Series champion, his fourth title in 5 years. He joins the elite four-time plus winners club: Dario Franchitti, Sebastian Bourdais, Mario Andretti, Scott Dixon, and of course, AJ Foyt.
I could have told you it was good.
Activate the glaze.
Me and Cam could have always told you it's good. What I could have never told you was that he'd be this good. When he first came in the series in 2020 with Coyne, I'm just like, okay, this will be fun.
Team Go livery on an Indy car? Hell yeah.
I like that. I'm glad he's getting a chance in North America as well. Would have liked for him to stay in Japan, but hey, this is good too. He goes to Ganassi, wins his first championship. Like, okay. Okay, that's really good. He's really showing us something here.
It was a surprise element of it, really, because I don't think anybody would have picked him to win the title first year at Chip in 2021.
We quickly forget, only beaten to his first Indy 500 at Ganassi by one of the greatest to do it at Indianapolis, and Helio Castroneves.
Mm.
Ruining that painting at the Concourse Club, man. I mean, we're going to have to save some of this for the season review, but Camp, one is, if you take out David Malukas having that oopsie, hitting him from behind at Detroit, what's his average finish on the year?
2.86.
In a spec chassis, only two choice of lease engines. Only things you could really tweak are the dampers and not much else.
Yep. And if you take his road course average of 1.42, which was only reduced because he let one go out of boredom to Scott Dixon a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Mid-Ohio was the only thing from stopping him winning every road course race on the calendar this season. Even if you give him the official 25th place finish in Detroit, former Luke has taken him out. His average finish is 4.33 this season, which is just outrageous. In fact, I can go one further than that. In the 5 years he's been at Chip Ganassi, where he's won championships in four out of those 5 seasons, his average finish at CGR is exactly 6.
That's pretty good. That's including a 2022 season where, perhaps of his own, part of it of his own making, there was the contractual dispute, and you could tell, in hindsight, that that was really taking a toll on him right up until Laguna Seca, where he closed out the year by just beating up on everybody.
Won that race by 30 seconds. Like, I could go further than this. Like, he's had 82 starts at Chip Ganassi. He's had 42 podium finishes.
How do you win a championship against that kind of consistency? You don't. It's as simple as that. The Chris DeHardy line.
You could take any random CGR race Alex Palou has had in the 82 starts he's been there. You have a 2 in 3 chance Alex Palou will sit on the podium. That's impossible. Ridiculous.
Look.
In a spec series, what are we doing?
In the same team as Scott Dixon.
Yeah, he's making Scott Dixon. Scott Dixon is not expendable. Like Will Power, that is a man who should be afforded the opportunity to decide when he goes out on his own terms and then some. But Dre, when he first won that championship, we talked about him being the Dario successor because there's a second car. Dario Franchitti held that down from about 2009 to 2013, and he was awesome at it until a career-ending concussion at Houston cut short a career that could have had a couple more years on it, right? Mm-hmm. And for a while, they kept plugging in guys like Tony Kanaan and Felix Rosenquist, Ed Jones. They don't quite do the same. They're more just very effective wingmen, but nothing else. Alex Palou was a risk to put him in place of Felix Rosenquist, who jumped to McLaren,
who is in his own right a terrific racing driver, and again having an excellent season over at Chang.
I'm not here to say that Alex Palou has surpassed Dario Franchitti, but if I have to put it out there that there is some case that he might have jumped him on the all-time leaderboards. Oh, by the way, he's 28 and he's got like so much longer to do this. That's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah.
He probably needs another couple of 500s before we have that, because we forget that Dario won 3.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and then
we talk about the road course average and that's pretty good, but I mean, it's not like Alex Palou's like he's just okay. I don't, oh God, he won the Indy 500.
Yeah.
And he added up another one in Iowa.
Yeah, the first, I mean, he's won on all four major disciplines this year, a road course, a street course, a short oval, and a super speedway. He's got his win count up to 19 now, and the first double in 15 years. The last time we had someone do both in the same season was Dario in 2010. So this is a first in 15 years. You know, we talked about the fact that last year he was the first guy since, I think it was Dan Weldon, to win early. Yeah. Now he's won this run 2 races early. He has a 151-point lead right now as we look at the table. Yeah. He
could have won this another race early had Belukis not run him over.
Dixon could have sent him on vacation and he would have won this early.
Yep.
I've got one more one for you as well. He's got a genuine shot to take down Scott Dixon's all-time points record for a single season. And when Dixon did it in 2017, we had a double point 500 and a double point season finale at Sonoma. He's 46 points away from that all-time record. This is what, on any measure, on any metric, on any level, this is one of the greatest IndyCar seasons of all time.
It's one of the greatest motorsport seasons of all time.
This is outrageous.
Like,
and he could still tie foot for 10 wins potentially.
Yeah, I don't think he ties the record, but that he's gotten to 8 wins this year putting him up in some of the elite company that he's in, and now the elite company that he's in of people that have won 4 American National Open Wheel Championships or more. It's so good. Hey, props as well to all the crew celebrating with their Astor Cup cutouts, because the trophy is not allowed to be presented early. They are saving it for Nashville.
That is so stupid.
It's contractually obligated, dog.
It's written in paper and blood that we have to reveal this trophy in Nashville Super Speedway, of all things.
Yeah.
I love always, it.
Always, please, always shown at the last race of the season.
Please love my dumb series. That's what that is. Get that man his trophy. And you know,
well, the good thing is,
for the last 3 years now.
Yeah, the good thing is he'll know exactly what it looks like, and he can tide himself over with a baby BorgWarner.
He's doing this with Penske having 3 outstanding drivers around him. Pato O'Ward, who's having his best championship season since 2021 at the bare minimum, maybe his best season period.
Here's the shame, I think, that will get lost in all of this. That I think, like, we talked about in the season review last year, that Pato needs to break that points barrier that he just kept average. That's like, what, 440 to 450 every single year?
Yeah, it was around 480. He's got 475 now with 2 to go.
He's going to smash that to pieces, and he just got beat 2 races early. Like,
I feel bad for that dude.
Pato has made so much progress in race trim, and the qualifying is really undone. Like, it's put him with a lot of work to do. But he has been a phenomenal racing driver this year, and he has been blown the fuck away.
Pato O'Ward has 2 wins and 9 top 5 finishes this season.
By any metric, that is a superb IndyCar season.
Yeah. I can't even be mad at Pato. He has stepped up this year, and it's not mattered. It's like Ken Griffey Jr. in the home run chase. He had 56 home runs that season in 1998, and we didn't care because it became Sosa versus Maguire, and the story just took over from there. It's the same thing here. It's not like Pato's been bad. Pato's been incredible this year. He's been the clear number 2 man in IndyCar this year by a comfortable distance.
And sneakily.
Dixon, Lingard, and Kirkwood. But it's just not mattered.
Sneakily. In third, we just can't get rid of this guy. Scott Dixon is putting together, like, the most stealthy third place championship finish that you've ever seen.
No Cliff theory.
No, it's because he just racks up top 10s for breakfast. He's only finished outside of the top 10 3 times all year, and one of them was an 11th and another was a 12th. Dixon just every week just doesn't have a bad day. Like, he has a few mid ones, but like, he just doesn't have bad seasons or bad days anymore.
This ended up being one of them by punting Newgarden into the oblivion.
Well, it ended up being 11th rather than what would have probably been 4th. It is what it is, you know?
On the subject of, like, because the Dixon putt on Newgarden, that's a clear-cut penalty. But now I want to get into the silliest thing I've ever seen for 20th place. Connor Daly and Christmas Rasmussen.
Christmas Rasmussen?
Christian. Connor Daly Christmas. And Connor happy Daly and Christian Rasmussen.
Happy Hanukkah.
Christian Rasmussen punts off Connor Daly after Connor Daly gives him a big old chop block in retaliation for Rasmussen running them off the road. Thankfully, nobody's hurt on this, but also no further action was taken by the stewards. And the general consensus was that Christian Rasmussen instigated all this, got retaliated against, and took it way over the top. But Dre, I think you see it a little bit differently.
I think that Connor Daly lost his head. And I know this is going to be an unpopular opinion. One, because Connor Daly is one of the people's champions of IndyCar. He's been given his own media platform under the Dale Network for a reason. He's a liked underdog figure, has been for over a decade amongst North American motorsport in general. Daly lost his head. And the reason why I think this is because the initial push that Rasmussen had when he pushed Daly and himself off the road, you can see Rasmussen twitch and nearly lose the front end of his car on the exit of that corner. That makes me think, I don't think Rasmussen was being malicious. It was, I think, a driver error. Of course, it was unfortunate, the outcome that led to that, and Rasmussen probably should have taken a position drop penalty for doing that. Not disputing that for a second. But the fact that Daly nearly pinched Rasmussen into the wall when they both rejoined, and then Daly swipes at Rasmussen on the turn one chicane on the following lap after the fact, which, for me, he had no chance of making that pass. He came from over a car length back to stick his front nose in at the apex. Not a hope in hell. That felt like retaliation to me. And you absolutely cannot do that. I'm not even talking about the main flashpoint at turn 10 on that lap yet. And Daly, I think, has already gone way over the line, frankly. The actual incident itself, I think they're both stupid. I think Daly absolutely pinches Rasmussen at the apex of turn 10, because Rasmussen has to go two wheels into the grass to try and initially avoid contact. And then Rasmussen, for some silly reason, doesn't back out of it when he knows he's beaten. The incidental contact spins Daly around and he goes careering into the outside wall. It was all stupid. Like, this was head loss from both men. And it was, as RJ, you summed it up perfectly. Head loss for P20. What are we doing here? Like, what is this? It was so stupid.
If I had a nickel, by the way, for every time that Connor Daly got into a spectacular accident, that the general consensus is that that's not his fault, or if not, this is entirely the other person's fault, and either no action was taken or he got blamed for it, I would have two nickels. And thank God this one didn't almost end up in the Monaco Harbor.
Yeah, makes a change. Look, for me, I'm not sure what's more laughable, the incidents between the pair of them, or the fact that Kyle Novak looked at that situation as race director and decided to not punish Christian Rasmussen for his role in it, or Connor Daly for the clear retaliation that led up to it.
Yeah. I think for Daly, the punishment was, well, you've just crashed out of the race.
Sure.
I'm not going to go as far as to say that Christian Rasmussen should be suspended for the rest of the season, but no. At least a stop-go penalty would have sufficed, man.
Dixon was given a drive-through for spinning Newgarden out, and Dixon barely touched him. It was a graze.
Yeah.
I actually thought a drive-through was actually harsh for Dixon, because I thought the contact was so minute that I thought, like, it might have just been Newgarden was slow off the apex. I wasn't fully convinced that Dixon was 100% to blame for it. How do you look at that incident and you decide not to punish them? What was the logic here?
I'm looking at an incident from earlier in the race where Colton Herta and Connor Daly are going side by side into turns 9 and 10, and, you know, there's Herta on the inside of the apex as Daly is swinging around to his outside at the left-hander, and Herta backs out of it. So I guess that's the feeling of just like, well, he backed out of it, but Rasmussen didn't.
And to be fair, Rasmussen has got a right to try and defend his position. I understand that, but Rasmussen either did not know he was beaten or stuck his front nose in anyway because he was being stubborn about it and was clearly incensed at what had happened between him and Daly in the first place. I don't know what only he knows the answer to that question, but in any instance, he has a key role to play in the head loss that came as a direct result of that incident. Quite frankly, I would personally say both men take a 6th place grid penalty for this round in Milwaukee, and they are also both put on probation for the rest of the season, where if they cause another incident like that again, they're suspended for the final round in Nashville.
Yeah, and it's Milwaukee. I know it's not a fast oval, but you really don't want to be playing those games, even on a short oval like Milwaukee.
No, fully agree with that. And again, this is not only a Kyle Novak problem, because I've had big problems with him as a race director since he inherited the job full time. But I also, there is no good reason why IndyCar can't release statements as to why they're giving out or not giving out penalties. If Formula One can do it over incidents that are under investigation, there's no reason why IndyCar can't do the same.
I mean, they brought him into the Fast booth a while ago.
You've already, like, got the infrastructure to do it. And the chat saying, well, Chris DeHardy suggested it. Chris DeHardy did, Joey Barnes did as well on his podcast. Like, he's not the only person thinking of this. But it's also just, we need information. Fans and as an audience member, the more information and the more transparent the process is, the more likely we're going to understand and empathize with you guys, even if we don't ultimately agree with your decision-making. Because, hell, heaven forbid, I don't agree with every F1 decision that they make with their stewards. Quite the opposite, actually. But at least they give us an explanation as to how they came to the conclusion they drew.
They used to have the race director like give post-race comments to the media all the time, and then that race director didn't have his job anymore.
Yeah, funny how that turned out. Like, it's incredibly frustrating because it leads to idiots like us getting on podcasts and then trying to fill in the blanks ourselves.
To talk about an incident for 20th place early in a race for two guys that were probably going to have, at best, a chance at a top 15.
Yeah.
If their days went good.
I can just say as well, Connor Daly getting on social media within minutes of his crash and immediately like implying that Rasmussen did it on purpose is really poor form. Like, get off your goddamn phone. Like, that is not the time to be venting your spleen.
Oh, but like, don't you know that sort of behavior is only unacceptable if the passport says Argentina?
I'd rather we not go down that road again. I'd love the Raptor in our chat, but not the first time a Junco's rider lost it on social media.
I don't think Connor is a bad dude. I think sometimes he doesn't know when to put his phone down, which is incredibly relatable. But I have to say, if you're out there one of these people that's just, you are just like stoking the flame of like, why shouldn't Connor clap back, etc., etc. But you had such a huge problem with the guy that was in the seat before him. I don't know, man.
Just admit you want beef. It's okay. Fine.
Yeah, we like beef.
Yeah, man, I'm on Twitter right now. I'm checking out those Joey Wheeler Air Max 95s. Those things are crazy. But man, like,
yeah, that's,
you know how I viewed it? Because I knew you two had opposing views, so I was just going to let you cook for a couple minutes.
If it was up to me, I thought Rasmussen bears a lot more of the responsibility. I think he should have backed out of that corner, and that would avoid what looks like a very hellacious accident. But I also understand that not every person saw Silverstone 2021 the same way. And not everybody judged Silverstone 2021. Again, I know we're, again, overanalyzing an accident for 20th. Jesus Christ.
Yes. That my biggest takeaway. Y'all really live like this for 20th?
Oh, Jesus.
But honestly, I kind of saw the final incident as, like, deliberate retaliation from both of them. Like, Connor just turned in, like, fuck you, you're going to back out of this turn, and Rasmussen left his nose in. I would have been absolutely fine with both of them getting parked from Milwaukee. Just dumb. Dumb behavior.
Yeah, they were both silly bitches. And, like, I'm not normally critical of James Hinchcliffe, who's the best of IndyCar's commentators and broadcasters by some distance. But when he is out here saying that, oh, like, Rasmussen was a victim of a reputational call, whereas, like, Rasmussen made a lot of enemies this year by how he's raced people, I don't think that's actually true. I think he's just been aggressive, but he's not ran anybody off the road until now. He's not.
We actually joked around the 500, anybody. Right? That he's like, he keeps trying to have an accident and he keeps being unsuccessful. Well, he had it this weekend.
Yeah, this was the one that went over the top, quite frankly.
Yeah.
He's had a lot. He's been the cat with nine lives, but he's not ran anybody off the road until now. He's not been dangerous or dinged for aggressive conduct or driving. This was so. I don't like when people make lazy narratives or calls based on reputation. That's how Romain Grosjean unfairly got a race ban. I don't like when people are making those kinds of decisions. Because look back on 2012 in Belgium and obviously that horrible crash that happened. Yes, Grosjean was probably to blame for it. But in no way in hell is that normally a race ban.
Yeah.
No chance. It was a call based on Grosjean's reputation with no system in place.
And the violence of the collision, because, I mean, hello, Fernando Alonso had a helicopter blade flying right across his dashboard.
It was a call based on optics and reputation, not what had actually happened or what Grosjean was actually responsible for. That's
so we
could
say the same thing. Like, if we're going to say, well, look at the violence of the crash. 2018, ironically involving the exact same man.
Yeah, yeah,
and
exactly.
That wasn't a race ban, but yeah. Look, if you're gonna do dumb shit for on track position, do it for like a top five.
Do it for a podium that could save your career. Christian Rasmussen, I think, has done enough to save his career. Same
absolutely.
With Bailey. He's in a good spot off the 500 alone. Like, don't do this for 20th. Now to get to the thing that we missed last time, because we always have a problem this year, Motorsport 101. The big news always drops after we're done recording and talking about the IndyCar series. And it hit our desk that Fox Television has now bought a 1/3 share of the IndyCar series for $135 million.
It's not only a third of IndyCar, it's also a third of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, let's not forget as well. They've bought a third of their headline track. Like, is it just me, or was it slightly concerning that the moment this deal dropped, my first thought was, wait, 1/3 of IMS and 1/3 of the IndyCar series as a whole is only worth $135 million in this sports selling climate?
Which makes you wonder how...
Spent £10,000 on an engine rebuild. Sold the whole thing for seven. Tells you how much the rest is worth.
How many times have we rewatched that Italian supercar challenge in the last month?
Well,
too many.
Well, you know, big end ending up in a bucket. Etc.
Yes! Cam Buckley has been shot! Okay. It makes you wonder, though, just like obviously, if you do the math, that puts the value of IndyCar at under $400 million.
Roughly. Yeah.
Roughly.
405. But yeah, you know.
This was a thing that was always talked about. Like, if some people were going to get their way and get Roger Penske and Penske Entertainment to sell the series, et cetera, et cetera, Michael Andretti suggested have somebody buy in the series and give a different perspective. Now this has happened, just not in the way we probably think.
Because we don't think
it would be the broadcaster of the series that just got into this thing.
That's my point. Am I the only one who feels a little bit uneasy with a broadcaster owning a third of a sports league?
Wow. You're not wrong to feel that. I think a lot of people feel like, okay, yes, we're getting outside investment. We're getting fresh perspectives. This is finally not going to feel like a continuation of the Holman and Company era, which is kind of like this is how I feel that the Penske era has not gone so great. It just feels like the Holman and Company era, but a continuation of it. And things are not going on the up and up.
Well, and the whole point of why it was Roger that it was sold to was more or less the handshake agreement that things wouldn't change much. And they haven't. It's been more money. It has been pumped into the Speedway and it's been pumped into not much else.
And as Kira Quarani points out in our chat, it's not just Fox the broadcaster, it's News Corp. The Murdoch family themselves were named in the statements when the series was bought. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. Rupert Murdoch is up in my top three of old white dudes that I hope dies already.
It's the same kind of running, like, when that man croaks, and we are closer to...
The
Pack Watch will be generational. It's gonna be that spliff that Tails was smoking in that gift.
I've seen that. I've seen the first season of Succession.
We have a running joke.
He shakes it off. He shakes it off after he has that heart attack in the helicopter.
We have a running joke in our Discord about the death of Henry Kissinger. You hear how he died?
Yes.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger's dead. And thank that's the bit. That will replace Henry Kissinger when it happens.
Oh, yeah. Between him and Vince McMahon, whatever comes first.
No. I'm going to throw in a spicy Mitch McConnell.
Ooh, solid.
That's a good one. So
this is the point. Like, Fox... The thing is, right, I do not like Fox. I do not like Fox's ownership.
Yeah.
I do not like the people that are invested in it, and I've already shouted at them for bringing in Barstool to collab with them to help try and promote IndyCar in the first place, because we all know Barstool is a rancid organization ran by a racist. I don't like this. I don't like the tools that Fox has called on, and even if I were to ignore that for convenience of, oh, IndyCar's gone woke, etc., etc., what exactly has Fox brought to the table for IndyCar outside of heavily promoting the 500, which we all knew it was going to do anyway because that's their cash cow?
Objectively, not great coverage of this year's 500. Power outages. Of course, the Thermal Club this year, soon to be dead Thermal Club, throw that in the Pack Watch too, is lost media because we missed like a quarter of that race.
Like, the broadcasts have been sloppy at times with technical errors riddled throughout this season. We had it again during this last race, where for several minutes the timing tower was frozen on its gaps. Its GPS has not worked particularly well, which worked perfectly fine before Fox was around last year. Will Buxton, in my opinion, and I like Will, but he's not, in my opinion, added much to IndyCar as a broadcast. I think Jack Harvey's been the real power move, having him in the pit lane. I think he's been excellent for what it's worth. Georgia Henneberry's been superb.
Which is crazy, because sometimes I hear people say that Jack Harvey's a liability as a pit lane reporter. I don't know. Maybe we see things differently.
I think he's been excellent.
Completely wrong. I think he's been excellent. I think, as Kira Quarry points out, I think Will's a great presenter, but he's not a great play-by-play commentator. That's a very hard thing to be. He's an excellent guy with a mic to host your broadcast. And don't get me wrong, we were spoilt with Lee Diffie. Like, we were absolutely spoilt with how good he was, and he could do everything.
Now he gets to commentate over NASCAR and do a great job over there and hurt all of the people who watch Fox News, hurt all of their fifis constantly.
Or the people that haven't been relevant since RPM Tonight was put between its eyes. The broadcasting's been a mess. The basic way that we expect this to work is that none of the leadership group running Penske Entertainment, for better or worse, is going to change, which means you're still going to have Doug Bowles, still going to have Mark Miles, but we're probably going to have more additions to the Penske board, like Eric Shanks, Fox CEO, and they're going to have more opinions to bring to the table. Those opinions could be good. Those opinions could also be, as some IndyCar insiders had alluded to, adding... the one thing that we really, really do not want this series to generate excitement.
Right-wing influences?
The P word.
Oh, that P word.
Yeah, nothing concrete about it. Drivers have been asked. It's all murmurs. Nothing concrete about it.
All the drivers have said no.
Let me make one thing absolutely clear. If IndyCar brings in playoffs, I will no longer be on IndyCar episodes on this podcast.
That probably means those episodes won't exist anymore, right? But, like, how do they do it? Because, in theory, unless the winning the Indy 500 just means you win the playoffs, People are going to go fucking berserk about it.
Are they going to do like a indie racing league thing where in 96, 97, they had the season start after the 500 and end at the 500? And they tried that like once.
It was stupid. And then
they said, never again.
It was stupid.
Just like how
it was stupid when WEC tried it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we're going to begin it at Le Mans and we're going to end it at the next Le Mans. No, it just sucks.
Let me make one thing absolutely clear. This is a really, really nice way of saying you don't like Alex Palou's dominance.
Because we don't like any dominance.
I think it's beyond that. I think it's, well, we just got to chase whatever NASCAR's doing. Because NASCAR is healthy right now, right? And the problem, NASCAR is beholden to the same thing. Where NBC does not own a stake in NASCAR, but NBC has far too much power in defining NASCAR's format, and NASCAR just goes with what they think.
Yeah, we should be chasing, for better or for worse, is Formula One, because as it turns out, having a full season championship format is not hurting them, and they're making all the right moves. And if you're an optimist about this move, you're hopeful that Fox Sports is going to reel back the hourglass, the sands of time in the hourglass, and capture some of that energy it did when they got the NFL rights 30 years ago and put that towards promoting big events like the Arlington Grand Prix, which they want to be a big deal, a potential race in Mexico City, which they want to be a big deal. They want to avoid stagnation with this. But is this the right people to do it? I don't know.
I tell you, I'm about to get on a plane a week from now. I'm going to be on a plane to go brave the danger presented by Chris DeHarty. To hang out with him and get in his car, drink some root beer, and drive up to Milwaukee. So I'm going to go to an IndyCar race. I'm going to try and get Alex Palou's autograph again. I will not go to IndyCar races if they have playoffs. Straight up.
No.
This could be the shot in the arm that turns the series around and helps it, you know, avoid trending towards mediocrity.
It's going to be a shot in the arm of pure fucking botulism.
Yeah, or it could be the shot. It could be the shot in the arm that makes you feel so good, see if it's so much vitality, or it could be the shot in the arm that leaves you throwing up in the toilet that night and never knowing when you're going to stop.
The thing is, though, is that this has been year one of Fox, and Fox actually hasn't done all that much besides heavily promote the 500. So,
yeah.
Like, I'm not sitting here, I'm not sure how much influence Fox is actually going to have on this, but from what I have seen so far, I can't deny it. The 500 pulled in 7 million viewers. It works.
It's the 500. It's going
But it had 2 million more than last year's. That was a huge increase. Like, it was the most watched Indy 500 since unification. Like, I can't deny what they did for the 500. I'm not just, didn't like it at times. It worked. But why is that not applied to all the other races that Fox has had?
Because they're not the 500.
That's something that they outside of St. Pete. Good first start, good first act, but
and then half their audience died by round two.
It does. We have a loyal audience of about 700,000 people that will watch this on antenna or basic cable. You know, not to discount people who watch abroad or by other means. It's tough.
We just don't know yet because we're too early into this. But given the murmurs that have been floated around, I do not feel good.
Me neither. But we'll have to wait and see what Fox brings to the table. We've got two rounds of IndyCar left for 2025. Milwaukee and the Milwaukee Mile will be in. And he'll be there. Cam Buckley will be there for the Milwaukee Mile in a week and a half's time. They're on break. MotoGP is back this weekend, as mentioned earlier. They're back for their first
news from the two-wheeled world.
Oh, yeah. We'll be talking about that next week after the Austrian Grand Prix, which will be on my birthday. Weird thing to say.
Happy birthday, man. Also, by the way, as we're wrapping up, don't you think it's crazy that even IndyCar got upstage when it comes to like television networks investing in sports leagues? What's up, NFL? How we doing?
Oof.
7 hours of red zone football starts now. You'll be back next week to talk about MotoGP
in the world.
You'll be back next week to talk about MotoGP in Austria for the Austrian Grand Prix. Will our bikes continue? We'll have to wait and see. Until oh, then, I'm Andre Harrison.
We've put Mark Marquez on a current Ducati at Austria.
Have fun. They've been Cam Buckley and RJ O'Connell. Until next week, thank you very much for listening. Sayonara.
The best part about all of this, we get to re-rack them and do it all again next year.